In this residency, my project was a novel interface in which two player can engage or compete, but not with actual joysticks, but instead here you have plants as live, actual living plants, which are game controllers. And do they put plants' life at risk in order to compete with each other?
Ordinary citizens are always the one that's impacted the most by every governance change or environmental change.
When you talk about things like giving rights to the environment, what about all the humans that don't have rights?
They resist with rocks, right? They resist at the front line of resistance when the bulldozers come to excavate their villages, but they're not part of litigation.
And laws do not mean justice. What are your thoughts?
Things were better before the laws came. Complicated laws with complicated terms, which nobody, I don't even think the people who drew them up, really understood.
Laws are problematic, but we have them. I think it's important to use what we can to push back, repurpose them for the benefit of both us humans and non-humans.
I don't know how many people who are sitting here have seen a butterfly in their garden, how many have seen caterpillars in their garden. How many have seen squirrels in their garden? All this has simply disappeared from Karachi.
The destruction of Malir's agricultural fields, orchards, farms. We've seen a loss of agricultural land and now intrusions into Kirthar National Forest, which is a protected area.
There's a lot of collateral damage already happening in the world.
Whenever you deprive, you always say it's collateral damage.
Hello and welcome to the Artistic Research Residency Podcast. In this series, we explore innovative projects developed during the residency, replay, reveries of an urban dreamland. The resident researchers designed novel interfaces for human and non-human interactions in the urban environment of Karachi. This Artistic Research Residency is a collaboration between the Institute of Business Management and Umbrellium, supported by the British Council.
Like to call Arsalan Nasir to showcase his works and discuss his works. Ladies and gentlemen, a big round of applause to Arsalan Nasir. So we'll have a quick overview from Arsalan himself before we invite our guest speakers to discuss their own practices in connection with collateral damage we have been facing in the city. So Arsalan, over to you.
Thank you, Taki. Thank you everyone for coming today. Basically, in this residency, my project was actually a response towards this very unique strategy Usman and Link gave us, a thematic that we need to create novel interfaces between non-human and non-human interactions in an urban setting. So I'm born and raised in a very humble old city area, where we used to have this video game shops as a communal spaces where we used to go and play video games where we have our friends, our opponents, our like enemies, all sort of like discussions were used to happen in those communal spaces. So I was very much interested in these obsolete communal spaces, which are becoming less and less over the period of time, because now we have smartphones and other types of home interfaces to play video games, to engage with public through social media, through internet. And as time is passing, these communal places where very interesting discussions used to happen are like decreasing. So the whole idea was to revisit that culture, video game culture, which used to happen. And the thing is, we play many video games online, but the opponents with whom we play or the participant with which we collaborate are like not physically present. But when you create a situation where two players are competing with each other or fighting with each other, there's more than just game happening, other things as well. That sensory experience is very important. In this game, I created a novel interface in which two player can engage or compete in a, there's a conflict fighting scenario And two player can compete with each other, but not with actual joysticks, but instead there's a novel interface. Here you have plants as live, actual living plants, which are game controllers.
And so this is the collateral damage you're referring to.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a choice and there's a risk factor. Like you can choose to fight or you can withdraw from that fight.
Great, yeah. Great. So collateral damage as a broader theme, we have very special guests who have been working addressing collateral damages we've been facing. So I'd like to call upon mentor to a lot of us. He has been the backbone of our understanding, insights about the city, its culture, its sociology, and he has been sort of a person all of us look up to, and we're honored that he has joined us today. Please welcome a big round of applause for Mr. Arif Hassan. Along with Mr. Arif Hassan, I would like to invite a very special person who has been battling out things with farmers, joining hands with farmers against the urban development. Please give a big round of applause to Abira to join us and take the stage. Thank you very much, Abira and Arif Saab, for honoring us with your presence. And you've seen collateral damage. But while we were discussing a short while back, there's a lot of collateral damage already happening in the world. So just some quick thoughts on that collateral damage. Please, Arif Saab, if you can talk about it.
I liked your clips very much. Mm-hmm. And I think the subject is very important for a variety of reasons. One is the way you have picked it up. Species and their usages, and how they create places where a lot of interaction results in a feeling of deprivation. But the subject is important for other reasons also. More than 30,000 of our compatriots are supposed to have died by collateral damage. Although really it was murder, it was not collateral damage. It didn't happen accidentally as you have shown something happens. So I think that is very important to understand that. And now we are told that mass murder is also collateral damage. We are being told that quite shamelessly. And I wanted to point that out as well. So whenever you murder, whenever you deprive, you always say it's collateral damage. But having said that, I think the way you have put things across, it gives a better understanding of the city. And these are pockets all over the place. The areas that have been left alone to find their own way, very much like the people who live there, they also have to find their own way. And it can be a beautiful anthropological study of an area that has been developed like that. Maybe you can do that next time. Talk about people, not only the space. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Arif Saab, for your thoughts. And we'll continue our discussion with Abira. You have been looking at collateral damages for a while now. So I wanted to have your thoughts.
Sure. Thank you so much. Thank you, Arif Saab. For starting us off on a note of resistance, and I'm really glad that we put it out there. The world is indeed a horrible place right now. But in terms of collateral damage, that's not a term that I've ever used in our work, but it's interesting to think of it that way. But since we don't have a lot of time, I'm just going to highlight maybe two of the housing and environmental justice struggles that may be relevant to some of the things that we're talking about today. So as an activist, as a teacher, as a lawyer in Karachi, you know, I've had to see with my indigenous, you know, brothers and sisters, allies, the destruction of Malir's agricultural fields, orchards, farms, with the construction of the Malir Expressway, and then with gated communities all along the M9, we've seen a loss of agricultural land and now intrusions into Kirthar National Forest, which is a protected area. And some of the ways that we as lawyers and as activists have navigated is to use, you know, legal and political strategies. So going after the funding, whether it is the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank that was, I guess, in all their wisdom, funding the Malir Expressway. And there are a lot of people over here I saw who were part of that struggle, and we managed to stop the funding. Then we're looking at Kirthar National Park, which had a whole regime of game watchers until the 80s and 90s, which has gradually been disintegrated, and just a ruthlessly elite capture for construction. One of the things that Taki had mentioned, participatory governance, right? EIA hearings, and what we saw, whether it was in the case of Malir Expressway or in the case of the demolitions that we saw in Center City, in Orangi and Gujarnala, is that the EIA process has become a mere formality, and it's very easy for them to churn out 800-page EIA reports, which have a lot of language, but it's really non-meaningful, that entire process. And the entire sort of ecology of participation, right, to protect your environment is, I mean, there's so much to say about it, but perhaps I'll just point out the gendered impacts of it, right? So when we're looking at, you know, farms where women had a certain particular role in farming and pastoral work, they resist with rocks, right? They resist. They're the front line of resistance when the bulldozers come to excavate their villages. But they're not part of litigation. And they're not part of public protests. And they're not part of the entire environmental process. It's not participatory. So if we connect this Kirthar and Malir to the Delta, and then if we move eastwards towards Badin and the Indus Delta, we see another destruction over there. And we see that in the form of migration, which is why in some of my work, whether it's, you know, activist litigation or even in writing, we connect climate justice and migration to housing justice. Because if we don't have lower income subsidized housing, if Malir Development Authority with a mandate to provide low income housing is going to use that mandate to regularize land for Beharia and DHA, then what are we going to do when we have waves, as we've been seeing in the last 20, 30 years, of climate injustice migrants coming to the city and looking for livelihoods and looking for housing, and your entire nullahs, which are basically kachiyabadis, which has been regularized, and, you know, Arif Hassan Saab, you know, is part and parcel of, like, this whole regularization process, which I would say was working brilliantly at some point in the 80s. It started in the 90s. And now we see the state sort of completely dismantling all housing rights and ameliorative apparatuses that give people justice. And then, of course, you know, lastly, I'm just going to point to the neoliberal economy. And what we see in Gaza is also part of this economy, because weapons manufacturers Halliburton and Lockheed gain so much. And the same economy we see over here, you know, in the form of World Bank and Asian Development Bank loans. And of course, a lot of our GDP then goes to repay these loans, and a lot of the projects that they're funding, for example, the flawed left bank outfall drainage, which has exacerbated climate injustice in Thatta and the Indus Delta, all the way to the infamous Malir Expressway project, which was really just going to link two elite housing societies and perhaps hike the real estate values on both ends, to other projects like Project Sweep, which we linked and managed to convince the World Bank to retract their $11 million funding. And so we count these as, you know, I mean, if you look at Marxism, judiciary and the law is really facilitating capital. But there are some ways you can sort of chip away and find some justice. And, you know, you have to use whatever justice you have available. So, yeah.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Abira, on these thoughts. And very interestingly, like Abira mentioned, all these situations, Ling has been very strongly connected with politics and gamification of these scenarios. So Ling, you have thoughts. So almost seems like we're living in a video game, somebody else setting the rules, somebody else setting the laws and asking us to play the game.
I actually wanted to connect back to Arslan's work because I think it's really interesting what both of you are talking about, because whatever you mention about issues with the world, with the environment, ordinary citizens are always the one that's impacted the most by every governance change or environmental change. And one thing that Arslan is trying to do in your work is to bring your work to public spaces and to directly interact with passive audience, with ordinary citizens that is on the ground working. So I'm really interested for you to maybe tell the audience more about your experience working within that context, because it's not usual to what you have been doing in galleries and White Cube. And maybe tell us a bit more about some of the responses from the participants, from the work, and also what do you think as designer, as artist, what we can learn from this work?
So I was looking at existing structures of like how these plant vendors work around the city and go into the dense populated areas where we usually don't go. So I was working closely with these people who have like life experience to maneuver around the city. And I picked a very generic, like an existing makeshift mobile structure for my artwork, which can travel and interact with like these general audience, by this passive audience who can interact and engage them in a dialogue where they can talk about or at least experience that this is a very unique situation. They never played a game. They always played a game on a joystick, but now they have plants. So what choice do they make? Do they put plants' life at risk in order to compete with each other, or they engage in other discourses? So surprisingly, it was a very unique experience for me, because on street we were actually engaged in these kind of discussions for a little bit of time from our mundane routines. We talked about other stuff which is not happening on the street. And art has this very interesting power. It can intervene into a public space and can offer you and very exciting opportunities to engage this general audience into a discussion. And you can actually learn from them. They are more careful and more empathetic towards these plant species. And I was working with Azizullah Saab. He told me that a variety of like age groups come to him every day. They buy plants, these small potted plants, and place them in their windows, in their like these limited spaces, wherever they can. And they are interested in these things.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Arslan. This brings me to Usman's earlier works, and when he used to think that art lets you get into spaces where architects are not allowed to. Usman, what are your thoughts on this? Like Arif Saab mentioned these models, and like Abira also referred to participatory models. So what is your take on these things?
Well, I'm kind of interested, again, just to draw some parallels here. I think one of the key things that, Arslan, I think you were looking at was this dilemma, the ethical dilemma. You want to play the game, but if you play the game, you're going to damage the plant, most likely. And I think there's a similar ethical dilemma when you talk about things like giving rights to the environment. What about all the humans that don't have rights already? And it'd be interesting to know, Abira, just more how you see that. I have my opinion, but I'd love to hear yours.
You know, when I was listening to you talk earlier, and I was thinking of River Atrata to add to your list of personhoods. And it's a river in Colombia, which has also gained that status. And I think it connects really beautifully to how people in Malir and Gardab connect to the environment. And so there's definitely a human aspect to the collateral damage that Taki was talking about. But what we're seeing is basically a whole culture, a whole history of peoples, a whole oral tradition of folklore and the poetry of Shah Abdul Latif Bhittai, who is the Sufi patron saint poet of Sindh. You know, and every mountain has a certain identity, a story connected to it. And, you know, the indigenous people famously talk about how Behria's Masjid is built on where Bhittai had come and sat with the people of Malir and had a kacheri. And some of his, you know, one of his seven queens had treaded there in his Shahjo Risalo. So there is a loss of all that. And there's also a loss of these ancient goats that trace their history back to, you know, 1700 years, their language. And now they're fighting to survive. And if you visit these areas, you'll see it's exactly like Palestine and Israel, because they're gated and these villages are struggling to survive within these gated. And women's industry, which I mentioned earlier, has completely gone down. So whereas before these gated communities, they could access education and all the pastoral networks with their cattle, they can't anymore because they're blocked by these walls. So I think that definitely in terms of social, cultural, and economic loss, there is a lot to be done over here in getting legal recognition for, and perhaps which already exists. And one last thing I'm going to say is the term indigenous. The term indigenous is actually a contested, not, it's an evolving term, because there's a UN declaration on indigenous people. There's an older ILO tribal and indigenous people. And so, but officially, when we were fighting our case before the Asian Development Bank, they only recognized the Kalash as indigenous people. But the way that the farmers of Gadab connect to their environment and the way they have done sustainable agriculture and also protected the various mammal and bird species of Kirthar and treated their bays and their goats as protective buffer zones. And when we were legally researching it, we couldn't find that anywhere, but it's part of customary law. And so there's a loss of all this tradition, including customs. And now that the Sindh government is coming up with a rehabilitation policy, which is ironically and curiously modeled after the World Bank ESSF5 involuntary resettlement policy, we see them making token references to customary law. But have they made the effort, right, coming back to your issue of talk of participatory development, to actually go and document and give life to those customary traditions?
Yeah. Thank you, Bira. Arif Saab, you had a very interesting take on having laws or not having laws. Society with laws sometimes are far better off than society with laws. And laws do not mean justice. What are your thoughts?
First of all, I'd like to say that this city has swallowed up 2,338 listed goats or villages. Where we are sitting now over here, there were goats. Where my house is, that was a goat. Where the American school is, that was a goat. Hill Park was a goat. The Jheel Park was the quarry of that goat. Where have they all gone? They were pastoral people, and they had pastoral land. We took away that land and left the goats so it couldn't survive. Most of the time, that is what happened. I've forgotten what you asked me.
I asked you about the laws, because...
Yes. You know, I worked on a lot of laws, especially those pertaining to the regularization of housing and the Kathiyawadi Act. Things were better before the laws came, because there was general acceptance, it's all right as it is, let it go. But then the laws came, complicated laws with complicated terms, which nobody, I don't even think the people who drew them up, really understood the vocabulary. The vocabulary is very important. It means a lot. It defines a lot of things. So that has been my understanding. And if I might say how things have changed, because it's important, especially because you mentioned the neoliberal economy. When I started working on Karachi things, especially low-income settlements, there were no NGOs and there was no such thing as civil society. They didn't exist. When an area had problems, they invited the representative of the National Assembly or the Provincial Assembly. They garlanded him, they sang his praises and just before elections and said, we'll vote for you if you give us this. And if he didn't agree, they would raise slogans against him. If after being elected he still wouldn't agree, they threw stones at his office. So then he had to negotiate.
And stones worked.
Yeah, they worked. They worked most of the time. Today, the leader goes to an NGO. The NGO draws up all that is required and needed for petitioning the government. And he becomes subservient to that NGO. Most of the time, not always, there are exceptions to this. And that is where all the laws come into focus. I can assure you that most of these laws the government of Pakistan cannot even implement if a few stones are thrown. But they are implemented because there is this whole support of educated people who interpret them, file cases. I mean, this is my experience of over 50 years. Maybe I haven't observed well enough, but I think I have.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Arif Saab. On a last note, Usman, just quick words on how you see things about having laws and not having laws and embedding a bit new artistic practices.
I think there's something quite interesting going on in this process of coming back to the topic of giving rights to the environment, which is that the power that corporations have in this world has been bestowed upon them by laws. And they did that originally by incorporating, which was to say that a company has a body. And what's very interesting now is that there are attempts around the world to use that same legal framework to give a body, a beingness to non-humans. And so I sort of agree that laws are problematic, but we have them. And as you were saying, I think it's important to use what we can to push back, to create something, to really, if you like, repurpose them for the benefit of both us humans and non-humans.
Yeah, please.
Something that I would just like to point out, I don't know how many people who are sitting here have seen a butterfly in their garden. How many have seen caterpillars in their garden? How many have seen squirrels in their garden? All this has simply disappeared from Karachi. It's all gone. And it's gone. Also birds, you only see kites and crows, which are scavengers, apart from the birds that come in winter. All this is gone because of the nature of development that has taken place. All this was there, even though it was not a green city, but it was there because of the pasture land. I think we've simply never taken notice of this. It has not been important to us. And we've got used to living without it. And, you know, just a minute or so I'll speak. I have really, but I am sure that a difference is being made in the younger generation today. Because they are taught about these things at school, which we were never taught. They are taught about animals, they are taught about not against body shaming, they are taught of respecting people irrespective of their color, etc., etc. And what I find very important is the reports that I receive, that the majority of people who are protesting in Europe in favor of Palestine are these people of so-called Z generation and the generation before that. And I feel that This is the result of the education that they have received. And we also in our schools now receive similar education. In the schools even in Kathiawadis, it needs to be promoted, it needs to be supported. It creates a better person, a better community. So I think it's important what is happening.
Oh, thank you very much, Arif Saab and Abira, for sharing your thoughts, and Arsalan for such a wonderful work. I hope this goes forward. And thank you very much. We'll move on to our next session.